My name is Joel Tickner. I'm the project director at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, and I direct the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council. I would like to welcome you to this quarter's GC3 webinar, and we are going to be having a webinar today entitled Greener Products, the Making and Marketing of Sustainable Brands. Our speaker is Ally Anuzzi from Johnson & Johnson. In previous webinars, we've carried the issues of challenges of advancing safer products through supply chains and how different actors along supply chains are addressing those challenges, ranging from retailers to manufacturing firms to the software and technical service providers who are providing support to the firms trying to advance greener products. In today's webinar, Ally Anuzzi is going to talk about his new book from CRC Press, where he tries to pull together the case of, through case examples, his own experience and lessons from other experts in the field of why companies need to provide greener and more sustainable products, and then the challenges and opportunities for marketing those products. So Al's going to talk through examples of lessons learned for advancing safer products. Ally Anuzzi is the senior director in the Worldwide Environment, Health and Safety Department at Johnson & Johnson. He directs their Global Product Stewardship and Green Marketing Programs. He's been with the firm for almost 30 years and leads Johnson & Johnson's Earthwards Greener Product Design Process, their Healthy Future 2015 Product Stewardship Sustainability Goals, and their Green Marketing and Emerging Issues and Environmental Toxicology Programs. Prior to J&J, Al worked for the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection and at an environmental consulting firm. Al is an academic in industrial clothing who received his PhD from Union Institute in the University of Cincinnati and has several books and articles in the literature. So I'd like to welcome Al, and Al will speak for about 30 minutes, and then we will be moving into question and answer. Go ahead, Al.
Okay. Can you hear me all right, Joel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, good. All right. Well, first of all, I just want to thank GC3 for the privilege to share this information, and thank everybody for tuning in. My understanding is that I'll go through the presentation and we'll handle the questions at the end. I'll plan on going through the materials rather quickly. I just like to give you a little background on why I wrote this book. Sometimes you just, have a feeling you want to do something, and this is something I wanted to do. But I noticed there was not a book that combines both marketing and making greener products. There's Design for the Environment books out there. There's green marketing books out there, but I'm not aware of any books that combine the two, and that's really what I was trying to do in this book. And I was drawing on my own experience and a lot of case study analysis. It kind of forced me to read in much more depth about what companies are doing and what the issues are out there than I normally would do in my day-to-day work life. So that's the reasons why I embarked on this, and I'd like to just share some of the thoughts that I came up with and some of the studies. So the way that I organize the book is I start out with the, why bother? Why talk about greener products? And go into a lot of different drivers for that. And then some case studies on companies, some what I consider leading companies, on making greener products. And then how are companies communicating that? Because what good is a greener product if nobody knows about it? So that's a real important element to this. And then summarize some of the best practices and conclusions. So I'm going to go through this this webinar, and I'm just going to give you some highlights from the book, more emphasis on the case studies and the green marketing, because I think that's something that a lot of practitioners, which I think quite a few of us on the call here are in similar roles to myself, where you're trying to drive greener product development in your own organization. We're not as in tune to the marketing angle, and I think they have to work hand in hand. And my role actually here at Johnson & Johnson is a combination of both, where I am leading the product stewardship efforts, but also the green marketing efforts across our enterprise. So let me just move forward. I'm going to go pretty quickly on the case for greener products, but I just think it's good just to quickly refresh our memories. Why are we here? Why are we paying attention to all this? And I do recall a conversation I had with my boss maybe a year or so ago, where we were just like, just contemplating, saying, could you even imagine 5 years ago that we'd be in a place where we are now, where more than ever, we're not just like working on risk mitigation when it comes to environmental issues or our Design for the Environment programs. We're actually working on offensive strategies where we're trying to come up with ways to bring sustainability to our customers through our products and through services. And that is really exciting for somebody like me who's been in the environmental field from the very beginning when it was really just fighting real gross pollution type of problems, and so now here we are as a company looking at ways that we can bring this to our customers and making making some sales potentially for our company, which is really, you know, puts you in a whole other realm. So one of the things that I don't know if everybody has watched this video, but if you haven't, it's a really pretty neat video called The Story of Stuff. You can go there and watch it, and it's a pretty entertaining way of making the point that if everybody in the developing world is going to wants to be like the United States, and if they truly act like the United States, it's going to be unsustainable. If you look at the amount of waste that we generate, you think about with China and India, and they're trying to have more and more people move into the middle class. They want the products that we're producing, and if we don't change the paradigm and think about these things, the impact is just going to be huge. And that's why this is a really important issue for everyone to protect the environment, and also just to try to make a difference with your job, trying to do if you're working for a company like ours. So we are now being held as companies to a higher standard than ever before. And I thought this was kind of interesting, this article in Environmental Leader I ran across. I never saw it said like this before, but global environmental damage is $6.6 trillion and 11% of global GDP. And the top 3,000 companies are responsible for a third of that. So if you think about, if you're working for a company, a major company, you got a good part in this. So that's another very important reason for us to be focusing on minimizing the footprint of our products. Some of the key drivers for greener products nowadays, to me, the biggest, most important thing that has ever happened to drive companies to look at greener products is when your largest customer in the world, Walmart, is asking for greener products. It changes the whole paradigm. And when you start talking to commercial people more than you are to technical people, that's kind of a pretty good indicator. So now we're not only seeing Walmart asking for greener products, but pretty much all retailers like Tesco in the UK. And then there's the green building movement. You know, the LEED certified buildings has really taken off, and there's more and more of an emphasis on it. So how do you get a green certified building? Well, by implementing more energy efficient equipment or greener products and materials in your buildings. So that's driving greener products. Then we have green public procurement. The US EPA has guidelines. In Europe, they also have guidelines, and in other countries too. So that's another driver, as well as these indexes. Now, I know my company and many companies are paying a lot of attention. Are you on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index? What about FTSE for Good in the UK? It's meaning more and more to us, so we're paying more and more attention to this, and it's becoming more of a focus on not only the production facilities, but on the products. And then we have the advent of I shouldn't say advent, because life cycle assessments have been out there for a while, but I guess the advent of more of attention on life cycle thinking and realizing, like the example here when Procter & Gamble came out with a cold water Tide, because the biggest impacts are the hot water in washing, and looking at life cycle impacts, I would say years ago, we wouldn't have thought of that. We would just looking at minimizing the footprint of our production process or maybe some transportation issues. And And here now other companies are even focusing on the use of the product. The greatest environmental benefit is on that aspect of it because of life cycle thinking. So these are all the drivers. And I just put this one slide in here. What's Walmart's goal that's driving all this? Reduce zero waste, be supplied with 100% renewable energy, and to sell sustainable products. I mean, that's one of their goals. So if you're selling at Walmart, you're going to pay attention to this, and we're seeing this across all different sectors. It's not just retail. It's as a matter of fact, I'd say it's even bigger in business to business. So when you think about bringing a greener product to market, you know, to me it's like a balancing act. There's a lot of factors that go into it. A few of them are, you know, all these regulations that are out there, WE, ROS, REACH, not only in the European Union but around the world. So that's a challenge. And then you get the customers, as we established, are asking for greener products. And then there's the wild card, I would call it, which is emerging issues. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about emerging issues because I think it's pretty important. And we've had an emerging issues process at Johnson & Johnson for, I'd say, over a decade now. The reason we did this is... most companies have gotten burnt at one point in time or another. But remember, we had an executive who is retired from our company, but she used to say, when you're explaining, you're losing. So if you have to start explaining reasons about your product and things in your product, and it's you start going into a losing proposition really quick. Then there's this concept, risk equals hazard plus outrage. So it's not just about the science. You know, that's one thing that we have to come to realization that perception is reality. Even if you have all the science in the world on your side, and if you can't get that message out and you don't get the message out earlier, you're going to lose in a court of public opinion, and then you're going to have to do things to your products that maybe scientifically aren't really necessary, but you lost. Some of the current emerging issues that we're tracking at Johnson & Johnson, and I think other companies are looking at, are listed here. So I think a real big one that we're all going to have to pay attention to, and some companies like 3M and DuPont have come across this too, is biomonitoring. So we're finding, you know, there's more and more testing going on there, blood and body fluids, and finding all these trace quantities of chemicals. What does it mean? You know, is it really the cause for some of these diseases? And the whole idea of even mixtures of chemicals at very low levels in water, and what does that mean? You know, that's another issue I think ties into biomonitoring. So we're trying to track these things and see, you know, are we at risk by using some of these chemicals of concern? All right, so, you know, nanotechnology and these other ones, and the point is that in order to bring a greener product to market, you need to have a process to monitor these emerging issues and to get your businesses aware of them. So we use this little, like, diagram that kind of makes the point of where is your area of opportunity. So if you look at the very beginning, the lower section, the biggest circle over here, when an issue is just starting to be talked about, you hear some NGOs talking about it, and we do monitor what NGOs say, we pay a lot of attention to what they have to say, or and academic press, and we're looking at what kind of studies are being done, and then we see, is there any risk to our company? If we do start seeing stuff and we start reading it and we say, well, this is not based on science, what we try to do is develop papers that get in peer review literature, or speak at conferences, or even speak with some of the organizations that might be putting information out to try to get our information out. That's where your biggest opportunity is, excuse me, to influence the issue or to shape the issue based on science. But once it starts moving up into the area of the public policy, you know, we're partnering with our government affairs groups to try to get some of these studies out. We have white papers that we make available publicly and some just internally to alert our businesses. And then once it gets into a regulation, it's too late. And sometimes there's regulations out there that are, you know, we kind of scratch our head and say, we got to comply with these, but they don't make a lot of sense to us. And that is sometimes a failure for us to be running our emerging issues process the right way. So this is just like the wild card part of bringing greener products to market. So let's take a look at some greener product design examples. So in the book, I have a whole bunch of different case studies where I look at companies in various areas across the spectrum and see how do they bring greener products to market? What is the way that they do it? And see what we can learn from that. So before I go into that, I'd just like to say, I like to make the statement, there's no such thing as a green product. I don't know how that makes you feel, but I'll explain that. What I mean by that is that every product has a footprint. So think about a product you might think is the greenest one out there, an organic shampoo or lip balm or something like that. And you think about it, how did that product come to be? Well, there are raw materials necessary that were extracted or grown, and then they had to be processed and manufactured and transported and packaged and shipped and then used, and then the container and packaging has to be disposed of. So everything has a footprint. So I like to say, that's why I titled the book Greener Products. It's like a continuous improvement. You're moving up the spectrum. You're trying to minimize the impacts of your product as you go forward. So I would bet that those products that you think in your mind, whatever you're thinking of right now, a Toyota Prius or something like that, there's still opportunities for those products to become even more green. So that's why I never like to say green product. I think it's a misnomer, or sustainable product. I like to say greener. You're moving up, you know, and you have to be able to demonstrate that. And that's what a lot of these programs do. Like to me, GE's Eco Imagination was like the first program I did a case study on, because they've done a great job of promoting it, and they have an annual report and their website, and it's a lot of information about what they're doing. Their CEO talks about it. It's very much out there. So what is their program all about? They focus on only a few things: energy, greenhouse gases, water. And the key here is they're trying to offer benefits to their customers through these greener products or Eco Imagination products. Not only that, they put a significant amount of funding into clean technology and R&D for these products, and they even measure it and report on it publicly. And how do they measure success for Eco Imagination? They measure it in sales. So this is really based steeped in the business, which is, I think, a very effective way of doing this. So you could see that what they have targets, and they report on these targets when it comes to sales. And it's actually represented as a business initiative. It has a lot of support, and also they have third-party verification. They use the firm Greenwater to help keep their process honest. And they also have an external review board with people from academia and other places that critique and review. Those are some of the key elements to Eco Imagination. Now, Timberland's another one that comes to mind when I think about companies who are focusing on greener products. And then they have these objectives. Intent number one is to provide a way for their developers to make the products greener, empower them. And then number two is that the communication aspect of it is helping the customers to see that. And they came up with this nutrition-looking like label, food nutrition label, which they put on their shoe boxes. And they look at three areas: climate impact, chemicals, and resource consumption. And then you can see by the score and the overall score how the product's doing. And you can compare the previous version of the product to the current version of the product. Now, you can't really compare, you know, Timberland's boot to another company's boot without using their process, and I don't know if that's even possible, but you can see that they are making their products greener from one to the next, and they explain why and how. And that's a very important element of bringing greener products to market. So what are the key aspects of Timberland's program? They use the Green Index. They use ISO 14040 as a life cycle assessment management system, and they also set up goals, product stewardship goals, to help drive the greener products. And they also have a greener line of products. You'll see this in some companies. They have I would guess you could call it an all-green type of line, like Earth Keepers, and then they might have a green up the full of their products through goals, like enterprise-wide goals. Now, Seventh Generation, really interesting company to look at. From the very base of this company, it's been based on greener products. A matter of fact, it's kind of interesting when you read about them and you see, well, how did they come up with the name Seventh Generation? Well, they actually say that a company is based on considering the impact of their decisions on the next seven generations. And it comes from a Native American thought. They kind of built that in. And that's pretty impressive to even be thinking that far in advance. And it really helps you kind of frame up, I guess, when you're bringing a new product to market. So they have a big emphasis on natural ingredients and post-consumer recycled content in our packaging. They use a scorecard, which I'm going to show you on the next slide, which helps them to measure the improvements and steer and guide the product developers. And they're also committed to transparency of their ingredients, all the ingredients that they use. So if you look at Seventh Generation's scorecard, it's very interesting. They have these factors, and by the number of factors, you can see in the one column, like human health is 13 factors. That's where it's got a lot more weight. So, you know, that's like the most important thing to them. Then there's all of these other areas, water, you know, resources, packaging. And the really interesting thing about Seventh Generation scorecard is that they actually, it's the only one that I know of that I've ran across that actually has financial performance built into their scorecard. So there's several companies out there, including the one I work for, who has a scorecard, but they're the only one that I've seen financial performance. So it really gets into that whole triple bottom line thinking, people, profit, and planet. So that's kind of Seventh Generation's approach. Another thing that I found that a lot of companies have, and I agree with this 100%, that it's very important not only to have like a greener product framework, a way to make your products greener and a focus on, or even a green product line, but to have goals that apply to all your companies. So Clorox was a real game changer when it came to greener products in the shopping centers that are mainstream shopping centers. It used to be in the past you would only find the green cleaner in like a health food store or a specialty type of store. Now, you know, there's a whole section where GreenWorks sits where you go to even a home improvement store like Lowe's and you'll see green cleaners and there's like knockoff GreenWorks type of products on the shelf right next to them. They kind of broke the paradigm because in the past, greener products, especially in the green cleaning segment, were considered to be underperformers. They didn't really clean and they cost more. You know, so they kind of changed the paradigm because they're Clorox and they're trusted. You know, it's a trusted brand. And by having that little Clorox label, I think on this, you can see it perhaps on the image up there in the lower right hand side of the bottle. It helps the customer feel more comfortable with purchasing this greener product and that it's going to work. So then they set these goals, too, on top of it all, besides having the GreenWorks line. They have goals to generate one-third of their growth from sustainable products. So they're measuring that. They want to reduce the footprint of all their operations by 10 to 20% and make more sustainable improvements to 25% of their product portfolio. So again, they're looking across their whole portfolio, not just the GreenWorks. And also, they want to achieve an environmental stewardship reputation at consumer packaged goods levels, exemplary levels. So they want to be known as a company who's bringing greener products to market, and I think they've achieved that. Now let's look at Unilever. I mean, Unilever is a huge company. They use a lot of agricultural products as raw materials in their products. So they also have developed long-term goals in their sustainable living plan. They very heavily depend on life cycle assessments, and they look at sustainable sourcing. Interesting thing you see them doing, and even Procter & Gamble is doing this too, when it comes to educating the consumers on how to reduce their environmental impact. So they have like branded programs about that, getting back to that life cycle thinking, hey, the biggest impacts we can make is by certain products is how the consumer uses it. For my company, like if you look at shampoo, same type of thing, when you're washing it off, it's the hot water in the shower is the biggest impact for that use of that product in the life cycle. So how do you minimize the impacts? Well, you might have to do some education programs here. One of the keys is their partnership with their suppliers. So if you look at their goals for their sustainability goals, and they have really impressive sustainable sourcing targets and goals and information on their website and guidelines, and it's really impressive in what they're doing, I think. And they're really changing the game out there for people who are supplying products to them. So they're the largest producer or seller of tea. So, you know, if they start asking for sustainable source tea, do you think that suppliers are going to start paying attention? Well, they will. Well, look at their goals. By 2020, they want to have 100% of their agricultural raw materials sustainably sourced. So that's changing the game out there, and that's one of the ways for them to be able to speak to their customers about how their products are greener. Well, even in chemical companies are into this. You know, DuPont, BASF, I'm using as an example here. Others are paying attention to this. It makes a lot of sense. They're part of responsible care, so they in BASF has committed to voluntary global product strategy. They do risk assessments on their products. They use their own in-house developed eco-efficiency tool to demonstrate that the next generation of products are getting greener. And they also have this interesting program, this 3-to-1 climate program that aims to maintain a benefit of 3 times less greenhouse gas emissions for the use of their products compared to the market. So they're looking at reducing greenhouse gases by bringing products to market. If you're using their products versus another type of way of doing something, that you could actually reduce greenhouse gases by doing that. So that's one of the ways. Now let me talk a little bit about my company. Of course, I know the most about that. I was involved in really developing the whole EarthWords process. Our EarthWords is our scorecard and our greener product development process, which we have deployed over the last couple of years. We've had Design for the Environment programs before, but we decided we needed a better way of making it easier for our product developers and our marketers to understand how to make a product greener. So we had a Design for the Environment tool, but we felt we needed a clear line of sight to make the products greener. So we partnered with Five Winds International to help us develop this process and benchmark leading companies, like many of them on the call today, to see what they were doing. And we came up with these 7 focal areas. So materials, packaging, energy, waste, water, social, and innovation. And this program is a program that has 2 objectives. One is to develop greener products, and it's also to develop scientifically based, legitimate green claims. So we want to do both. So in Johnson & Johnson, as in many companies, if you get marketing on your side, you can make a much bigger impact than trying to work through your scientific community. So for us, we're a marketing-based company. Marketing is asking for greener products and it wants to get EarthWords recognized products. It's going to happen. So that's why that part of it was important. So we have a four-step process. One is risk assessment. We have to do risk assessment and compliance as part of our prerequisites. Then we do a life cycle screen. And then we ask our business units to try to make 3 10% improvements in the key category areas of those 7 that you saw. And then they have to complete a scorecard. And that scorecard then will be presented to a board. And on the board, we have independent third parties, someone from World Wildlife Fund and Practice Green Health is on our board, as well as product stewardship, legal, public affairs. And then we look at the scorecard and say, yes, you've made these 3 10% improvements. You have a proper documentation. And we would consider your product an EarthWords recognized product. And that helps generate claims and internal and external recognition for these products. So here's our scorecard. You can see some of the prerequisite questions. We do a life cycle screen. And then we have objectives. So I'm not going to go through all of them, but for example, in materials, you know, you can make a 10% improvement by dematerializing it, making it less. Like we have a blood glucose meter now that's much more than 10% less materials than the previous version. That's example, when it comes to more environmentally preferred materials, so maybe you're using post-consumer recycled content in a case to a product where you didn't before, or bio-based materials, or more natural materials, and likewise with energy, water, and those type of things, and even providing end-of-life solutions to your customers. So the scorecard covers a whole host of things. Once you made those improvements, you submit it to the board, and you can get recognition. So now I'd like to just change gears a little bit into the green marketing part of it. So in the book, I had a guest writer for one of the green marketing chapters, which is the Shelton Group. They're a group who does a lot of market research. And if you're not on their mailing list, you could just Google Shelton Group and get on their mailing list. And they put out like weekly a lot of interesting information on what's going on out there and consumers and in the marketplace and their thoughts on selling greener products. So should you market greener products? You know, sometimes we just do this stuff because we're accountable to society and to our shareholders to make sure that our products are greener, but should you even talk about it? And if you look at this quote here, which is in the Wall Street Journal, the CEO of PepsiCo, he said it's the one thing that everybody around the world cares about. And there's probably a good amount of truth to that. If you look at some of the research, a lot of people are interested in making sure the products they buy are greener. So here's just some statistics from 26 countries. You know, 86% of consumers were concerned with climate change. 71 said they would avoid buying goods that traveled long distances, and the 50 look for eco products. So that's across the globe. That's not just the United States or developed nations. Now, segmenting markets is pretty important to marketing people, and it helps you to figure out how to message and how to sell. So this is the way that Shelton does it. So they come up with four categories, skeptics, indifferents, actives, and seekers. Those in the actives and seekers quadrant are the ones that are looking for greener products. So it's the largest segment if you combine those two. So let's look a little bit about what are these segments and you know, what are they looking for. So the actives, which is 22% of the U.S. population, they are interested in getting greener products. They're, I guess you would call them, you know, in another way of saying it is like they're the dark green consumers. They're the people who are really, you know, going out of their way to look for greener products. So 81% said they would choose the environment over personal comfort or convenience. That's definitely not the average American. So that's where they're at. And they're concerned with chemicals that are found in cleaning compounds. So they'll be someone who'll be more interested in buying a GreenWorks type of a compound. And they do their research. You'll see them in the supermarket reading the back of the labels of a product before they put it into their shopping cart. So that's the type of person that they would be. The seekers are the largest segment. And they're similar to the actives, but they're not as wealthy overall, so they're a little bit more frugal in, with their decision-making. So they tend to look for purchasing things based on, you know, like they'll be looking for like an Energy Star type of appliance, something that's going to save them money and be good for the environment at the same time. But they feel responsible to be doing something positive in their life and even by purchasing their products. And they also probably would be willing to boycott a company if they thought they were a poor environmental performer. So that's the type of person that a seeker is. It varies, the messaging and the reasons for varies. And like I said, some might be for saving money. Some are to limit my family's exposure to chemicals. I don't know about all of you on the call, but I know our children, when they're growing up, my wife would always buy organic milk for them. Now me and her, we're not drinking the organic milk. It's our kids that are drinking the organic milk. So, you know, it's kind of interesting you know, how when you have a child, how it changes the way you think. But some people are focusing more and more on that and moving more into organic purchasing. That's the section of a supermarket is growing and expanding. Just about every major chain has a whole organic natural aisle, and a lot more people are shopping in that aisle. So how would you message to those people? Messaging is really a critical part of bringing a greener product to market and making it successful. Now, again, I'll say what I started with. What good is a greener product if nobody knows about it? So it's important to message and message the right way. So the actives, knowing who you're selling to is important. So actives, they are interested in harmony and health type of thing, so any messaging around that. They don't like the whole idea that, you know, they have money, so they, you know, don't talk to them about saving money by buying this product, or, you know, it's your responsibility or it's your obligation. That might work more with seekers than with actives. They gravitate towards like messages of enlightenment and truth, you know, and how they feel really good about this product, and they're real, the companies that they tend to purchase from are those that they really trust. Organic and natural foods are better than those that have preservatives in it. That's the type of things that they're looking for. When it comes to green household cleaners, you might want to message it on the health aspect of it, and away from, you know, it's your duty type of thing, or anything that makes them force, like, they, I got it, you got to buy this product. Plus, So let's look at some B2B green marketing. Got a bunch of different marketing examples coming up here. So it's they're really the biggest amount of green marketing going out there. If you really think about it, the retailers, you usually think about green marketing is, oh, I'm buying something in a supermarket, right? That's where green marketing occurs. Well, yes, it does, but it also occurs a lot when it comes to B2B. And this is becoming more and more important, a way to market. So Unilever is interested in life cycle thinking. They're interested in sustainably sourced raw materials like palm oil and tea. So suppliers that can help them meet their goals will get a leg up. And if they can help them meet those goals that I showed earlier in the presentation, earlier than they anticipated or reported publicly, that's going to make Unilever look good, and it's probably going to help that supplier get a sale. You look at Tesco in the UK, they have an 88-page environmental guide for suppliers. 88 pages. Can you imagine? So if I'm selling to Tesco, which our company is, we got to read that. We got to pay attention to it. And they're really big into footprinting. And they've done probably the most work that I'm aware of trying to put footprints on or carbon labeling on individual packages. And they're a big supporter of that. So if I'm selling to them, I'm going to be asking my R&D people to start thinking about how do we carbon footprint our products, and is there any greenhouse gas reduction story I can bring to Tesco to help message. So that's all B2B green marketing. If you look at the magnitude of this, so Walmart, Kaiser, Procter & Gamble, they all have scorecards. They've been very public about that. Kaiser Permanente is, a delivery network for healthcare, and they run a lot of hospitals, and they came up with this scorecard. We sell a lot of our products, our largest segment we sell to hospitals. So we pay a lot of attention to this Kaiser Permanente scorecard. So they're saying anywhere from 5 to 20% of the purchase decision that they make of a medical product will be based on sustainability and how you answer the scorecard, depending on the category. So, you know, when you hear that, you know, we kind of look at it as a tiebreaker or even could be a deal breaker. In some cases, they steered away from PVC containing blood bags, for example. So if you're manufacturing IV bags, I should say, if you're manufacturing an IV bag that has PVC in it, you're not going to get sales to Kaiser Permanente and some other hospital chains, too. So that's driving a lot of greener products and green marketing. Here, just look at Procter & Gamble and Kaiser Permanente, and they have a combined annual purchase power of $121 billion. That's only two companies. So think about all those companies out there. And Procter & Gamble has 75,000 suppliers throughout the world. So all those suppliers, if they're trying to help P&G to meet their greener product goals, they're going to come up with ideas and ways to sell this to them. And that's one of the drivers of B2B green marketing. So here's a couple of scorecard questions you might see. You know, it speaks about energy, regarding climate, waste, and in some cases. So what are some guidelines for green marketing? You know, we heard about greenwashing, and you definitely don't want to be a part of that, though there's a lot of greenwashing going out there. So the Boston Center came up with a couple of good guidelines I thought were of interest. You know, being precise, being relevant, be a resource, you know, to your customers, be consistent, be realistic with what you're doing. Don't overstate it. That's probably where a lot of people get in trouble, where they overstate or they use generalization type of terms. If you read The Seven Sins of Greenwashing put out by TerraChoice, you'll see that one of the biggest areas of greenwashing is just simplifying things and just not explaining, you know, why a product's greener and just overgeneralizing. So I came up with three keys to green marketing. One is to have a credible greener product story. You have to have data to support any claim you're gonna make, and it's got to be legitimate and proven. You need to meet your customers' greener product demand, so that's really critical when it comes to that. And then appropriately communicate the benefits of the product. You have to have a good communication platform. Here's an example: Honest Tea. Honest Tea in their who would this resonate with? You know, it would resonate with those actives we were talking about. You know, and it's a message. They even use the word authentic, integrity. That's the type of thing. They're the type of consumer who would purchase it. This is in their mission statement. You look at what their focus areas are: antioxidants, fair trade, sugar, less sugar, organic, and packaging. Here they became the first tea to have fair trade certified bottle of tea. They're trying to address the obesity program, and right on the top of the tea bottle is the USDA organic label. So they do this type of messaging around organic, and it's better for you and your health. Our company, we have Neutrogena Naturals, and here we try to get at some of the concerns. What market segment doesn't want harsh chemicals, dyes, or phthalates? So we get at that right away. We speak about the benefits of it, and when you purchase this product, you also support a good cause, the Nature Conservancy. GE's messaging is all about meeting customer demands. Here's an example. They sold 139 windmills, and the important point here is that you can relate to it. It's enough electricity for 400,000 homes. Well, that's a lot of energy. I can understand that. BASF is using certifications to help sell their products, getting third-party endorsements. So Dexo is the largest food service company. To get at the issue of overfishing, they've committed to sustainable seafood. So then how do you communicate that you're really serious about this? Well, you partner with a third party, the Marine Stewardship Council, or the best aquaculture practices. So anybody who's selling their seafood in their supermarket, if it has that type of sustainability tag on it, it's going to resonate with those people who are interested in that. Now let's look a little bit about eco labels. There's a lot of them out there. Which ones are most recognized? Well, not too many, actually. The top three, if any, are over 50% of the U.S. Population recognizes only three. More, you know, which is kind of amazing when I saw this. You know, recycled logo, the Energy Star, and U.S. certified organic. So you have to pick your labels wisely. So of the companies that I did case studies on, these were the eco labels that were used the most. It doesn't mean there weren't others that were used, but these were the ones that I saw the most. So that's kind of interesting. I kind of use that as, well, this is important to a lot of major companies, and they must feel that this resonates. And most of these do resonate with the U.S. consumer. Some of them the average consumer wouldn't even know anything about, but there's also the B2B market, and more, if you did that study with B2B, you'd have a lot more recognized labels on this list. How do you message? IBM, they use the Smarter Planet, right? So if you use IBM, you can reduce the energy. You know, buildings are big energy users. By using their software and their methods, you'll become smarter and you'll save energy. They portray it as IBM can help you with your solutions. If you see the last bullet here as an example, more than 20% of all the shipping containers and 25% of trucks travel empty. Better logistics can assist in reducing these and save fuel and reduce emissions. That's the messaging to the consumer. Partner with us, and we'll be able to help you with that. And that's how they do that. Philips is a company out of the Netherlands. They use these focal areas. So they have these focal areas, and they'll use these icons to communicate benefits to the customer. You can see on the bottom this ultrasound machine, how they show that the new ultrasound machine is more energy efficient, uses less packaging, less weight. So you partner those icons with that that messaging. And they also have a branded program they call SimpleSwitch.com. So this is another way for you to identify their more greener products. Now let's go look at best practices. This is I'm getting ready to wrap it up and go into the question mode, but I just wanted to give like a little synthesis of the leading practices that these firms that I've done research on have things that I think are the most meaningful and are most common among these leading companies. So what makes a greener product development program? So to make products, the best things you could do is to have top management support, a third-party input in developing your criteria, the use of scorecards, some mechanism to help and make it easier for product developers to bring your greener products to market. Don't leave it up to their guesswork or keep it kind of loose. Try to make it simple. I believe enterprise-wide goals are very critical to the success of a lot of these companies. So not just the tools to do it, but also goals to kind of force the whole portfolio to green up. The use of life cycle thinking and assessments are also by a majority of these firms are being used. Transparency is becoming a bigger thing, putting lists of ingredients like what SC Johnson has done, has committed to doing, and other companies putting this on their website. And then trying to meet the end-of-life requirements of your customers. Now, when it comes to green marketing, what are the leading practices? Well, communication is king. You have to have a way to make it easy for your customers to understand your products greener and how to put it into terms, like what GE did with the 400,000 homes, the energy equivalent. You know, something you can wrap your mind around as opposed to, you know, so many thousand tons of greenhouse gases. And that doesn't mean a lot to consumers and even procurement people within businesses. You know, they're not scientifically based, so they can't really understand how big is this. Use of well-known eco logos or third-party endorsements is what we're seeing just about every company had. Company-branded greener product lines like our Earthwords, recognized products, or Simple Switch or Eco Imagination, that type of, that's what I mean by that. Appropriate cause marketing, we're seeing a lot more of that, so, but the cause has got to have a connection to the brand, so don't support you know, something that reduces water, that's reducing water when water isn't that important to your brand. And prevent greenwashing by being authentic and having the proper data and training to your marketing. So, in conclusion, I don't see this slowing down, the demand for greener products. I mean, there's even data during the recession. There's still been a strong demand for greener products. I see it really strong in B2B and B2C purchasing, and I don't see that going down. And the key is really trying to hit this a sweet spot of when you're meeting your customers' needs with the greener product and you're reducing the footprint. And then when you hit that sweet spot, everybody's happy. So, Joel, I guess we can move into the questions part of it right now. I'm sorry for running through it quickly, but I thought it was best just to, you know, get a pretty good cross-section of some case
much.
Examples.
And why don't we open up for questions?
Yeah, hi, Joel. This is Mike Patel with Technet Apex. Is this presentation going to be available?
Yes, it will be available online in the GC3 members' site. It will be online, the slides.
But what if we're not a member?
It's a good incentive to become a member. why
you can always send me an email, too.
Ellen will get them to you. That's fine.
Joel, this is Rich Leroff. Question for Al. What lessons did J&J learn from the blow-up last fall where Campaign for Safe Cosmetics went after you folks on some chemical issues?
Well, it just reinforces the whole emerging issues process, Rich. And continuing to focus on these type of things and realizing that what I don't know if you were here for the whole presentation, but that whole idea that risk equals hazard plus outrage. So even if there's not science on your side, you still have to manage the issues. So, you know, I just say keep on attention to those type of things and try to stay ahead of them if at all possible.
Just to elaborate the question a little bit, you know, the details are the campaign raised some questions about a particular contaminant in Johnson Baby Shampoo, and I know you folks felt that you had the science on your side. Were there some communication issues there that in hindsight, were there some communication issues there that you, or communication lessons that you had to consider from that episode?
Well, I would just say you hit the nail on the head is communications, and keeping the line of communications open with groups like the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics and others, and trying to share the science that you have. You know, maybe that's something that to help to have even, we've talked to them, but maybe to have even more in-depth discussions. So it's important because these issues get out there, and, you know, if you look at the emerging issues, that little chart that I had, you need to get your message out there, and you need to be speaking a lot about these type of issues with those that are concerned with it. So if at all possible, you can help them see or agree to move in certain direction over time.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions? Well, let me frame a question for you. This is not the same as Rich's, but along similar lines, in the book, can you talk a little bit about J&J's commitment to phasing out the use of PVC in packaging? Can you walk through the process of how that firm and how the decision was made, and what were the drivers to that?
Yeah. So when it comes to PVC packaging, you know, we've produced over 3,000 tons of PVC. We've removed it from our packaging since we made it part of our Healthy Planet 2010 goals. Well, you know, that was an issue that actually was one of our emerging issues when we first started our process, Joel. We had received inquiries from groups that were asking us, you know, to actually remove PVC. We were monitoring the issue, and then we kind of came up with the conclusion that, you know, this issue is something that we really need to pay attention to, and we felt that it was something that we needed to make a commitment to moving out of PVC from our packaging. We kind of looked at it, and I mean, there is some science behind it for sure. When you look at PVC and it being able to be recycled, and in the manufacturing process, the issues with that, and we kind of felt there was enough of a that plus adverse public opinion or stakeholder opinion. We felt there was enough to really warrant making that type of goal and moving in that direction.
Great. Thank you very much. There are a couple of emails in the questions in the email file. Let me read you one, which is, how do you feel the new FTC green guides will impact companies' various green programs, especially their self-verification programs?
Yeah, well, we've been waiting a while for those FTC green guides. I mean, they're going to, you know, impact. I mean, we'll have to take a good look at it. I don't think they're going to impact us a lot because, you know, we look at not only the FTC green guides, but the ones that DEFRA has in the UK, and we're extremely conservative when it comes to communicating externally. But I think overall, you know, it's all going to depend on the amount of enforcement out there, and will the FTC really get after companies who are not following those green guides? That's where big impact is going to be, or not.
Great. Let me ask another one from the website, Al. In one of the slides, it was implied that Unilever values or even encourages the consumption of palm oil, which has some potential significant environmental implications, particularly in the rainforest. Do you know how Unilever has addressed those sustainability concerns? I mean, certainly Seventh Generation has been doing that, I know.
Yeah, I know Unilever, I believe, is a leader in the development of this sustainable palm oil coalition. So they're working with palm groves to source palm oil in a sustainable manner, as are a lot of other companies. But Unilever was had gotten protests and things against them because of that. But they kind of have flipped that, I think, and are, you know, a real leader in this area. And that's why I think they have such robust sustainable sourcing requirements. So I know the way that I'm pretty confident in saying that the way that one of the ways that they're addressing it is through this sustainable palm oil coalition. I think they might have even formed it, or they were definitely a founding member of it. I don't remember that exactly.
I had a question, Joel.
Go ahead.
Hi, Al. I had a question about the Earthwood scorecard that you were talking about, and you were saying that there are these seven categories. In order for it to be considered Earthwoods, it has to have made improvements in three of those categories. I had a question about, is there a baseline for that? Like, say, for example, in one of the categories, it might be way, way, way behind, but three of the categories improved. Like, is there a baseline included in that for all of them, or how would something like that work?
Yeah, we use a baseline of the previous generation of the product. So if we're coming out with a new blood glucose meter, for example, we're looking at the old blood glucose meter as the baseline. Now, when it comes to improvements, you know, again, keep in mind what I said about greener products. So we're looking, trying to encourage the right activity here. So if you were alluding to one of the categories is really not doing, they were really poor performing in that area, and they made a 10% improvement in there, that meaningful? Well, we feel like, yes, we want to, we want people to take credit for that, and we want to move them in that direction. So regardless of how high or low performing they are in any of those categories, we want to see them make improvements and continue to move the product line into a lower footprint, a more greener product. So we use the previous product as the baseline.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions people have? Well, I'll ask one more just going through the Neutrogena Naturals. Have you found that that separate Naturals product line has it been successful? Do you see J&J expanding it? Is it significantly different than the Neutrogena Normals, or how do you even account for the difference, right, when people go and buy it? Do they see as Neutrogena Normal as being problematic because now we have Naturals?
Yeah. Well, it's doing well, Joel, to based on my knowledge. We're trying to meet segment demands, you know, similar to what I showed in that that pie chart. If you remember, there's a certain percentage of the population that are looking for these type of products. That we use more natural ingredients in these products than they're, you know, close to 100% natural ingredients, whereas the baseline products are not. We don't see any problems with that because consumers are looking for both. So we're offering them both type of products. So that's, you know, really what it's all about. We definitely think that this is something that we want to do, and I think we're going to be seeing more of this these type of products coming from us.
Great. But they would go through the same, all the same safety measures that any normal product would be in, comparably in terms of safety. They'd have similar safety profiles, I would assume.
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, that was probably the biggest hurdle for us getting into this area because we not necessarily in manufacturing these type of products before, and now we are. So we have to, you know, kind of change the ingredients that we're using and coming up with those same safety profiles. But absolutely, the same rigor is required.
Great. Any other questions from people? We're going to wrap up here in a minute. Oh, here's another question from the web. What do you do for hazard analysis pertaining to what's in your product, for example, with the Earthwoods scorecard?
I didn't catch that. The hazard analysis?
Yeah. How do you do the hazard analysis within the Earthwoods scorecard?
I guess I'm not sure what...
Well,
about the hazard analysis.
Well, the chemical hazard comparison, for example, if you're comparing various alternatives for a formulation component, do you have a hazard assessment protocol that you use or a set of criteria?
Yeah, I understand
for comparing
it.
Those?
Yeah, I understand the question now. We have a various ways of doing that. So we have three sectors at Johnson & Johnson. We have consumer products, we have pharmaceuticals, and medical device and diagnostics. So you can't just do that in one way. So we have a whole suite of tools that are maintained to help the product developers to develop greener products. One of the tools we have is a chemical lookup tool, which color codes the chemicals that you use to steer you away from those that are more problematic or more highly regulated. So that's one way. Our consumer products group came up with a whole way to rate all their ingredients that they use, which is very robust, using toxicology principles and, you know, looking at PBT, that type of thinking. So there's different ways based on the different business units and different tools that could be used to identify that. We also have something called a watch list where we have chemicals of concern on it that we want product developers to steer away from. Part of the prerequisites or risk assessment section of our scorecard requires you to identify if you have any of those materials in your product. So that there's various methods to get at that.
Great. Well, any last questions? I guess let me ask one final one, Al. To what degree is your group, which is doing the sustainability EHS, linking in with your product designers? Do you feel like you have a very synthetic integration between product design and product sustainability, or is that still a challenge that needs to be overcome?
Well, we have a lot of business units, so it's probably all over the map. I mean, overall, if you look across the whole company, I'd say it's pretty good. But I would say it still needs to be improved. Like, we need to get a more understanding out there and more integration into the stage gate process of bringing a new product to market. And we're working on that, but it's, you know, still a challenge, but it's getting better, and it's, I guess, a constant challenge we'll probably always have there. But one of our goals is to make everybody aware of so that no matter who you are in a company, you'll understand our EarthWords process. And we're definitely not there yet, and we're trying to engage people to get to that point.
Great. Thank you. Well, if there aren't any more questions, why don't we wrap up here? I want to thank you so much, Al, for giving us your insights and wisdom. And if people are interested in more reading, the book, there's a link to the book right on the website right now. Our next GC3 call will be in March or April. Stay tuned for details of topic and date and time. Thank you so much, and have a good day, everyone.